Thanks for listening to Here and Now. Help us shape the future of the program and public radio as a whole. NPR wants your feedback and observations to enrich our news coverage and storytelling. At nprlistens.org, you can join the conversation. Voice your opinions. Make an impact. Visit nprlistens.org.
From NPR and WBUR, I'm Jeremy Hobson.
I'm Robin Young. It's Here and Now. Lots to get to, and we will, but with exactly 2 weeks until the midterm elections, we start this hour with a look at governor's races. Nearly a dozen sitting governors might be vacating those seats.
And keep in mind, not since 1984 have more than six sitting governors lost in any one election. So we're going to look at several of those races now. Joining us is Megan Verlee, reporter for Colorado Public Radio. She's with us from Centennial, Colorado. John Dankosky is news director at WNPR in Hartford, Connecticut. He also hosts the show Where We Live. And Frank Morris, national correspondent and senior editor at KCUR in Kansas City, is with us now as well. And Frank, let's start with you. And we should be clear, by the way, you're on the Missouri side of the border, but we're talking about
that's correct, Jeremy. In
Kansas. And Republican Governor Sam Brownback is facing a tough challenge in deep red Kansas from Democrat Paul Davis, a longtime state representative. And it sounds like this is really about Brownback's economic policies.
Oh, yeah, that's it. It's a referendum on this policy. He cut taxes. The governor led a tax cut, a massive income tax cut. He eliminated taxes for almost 200,000 firms and owned by individuals. These would be like law firms to well drilling outfits, and cut taxes for everyone else, the most for the highest wage earners, about 1.5%, and then about 0.5% for low wage earners. That was supposed to make America the best place in the country to run a small business, famously a real-life experiment, a red state model, but it hasn't worked out as planned.
And at a recent debate, Davis said that the governor's economic experiment, he called it, is not working.
What he's going to do is he's going to cut schools more. He's going to take more money out of our proven job-creating program, our transportation plan. That is not how we are going to continue to grow our state. I have a common sense plan that I believe Democrats and Republicans can support to get us out of this mess, and that's where we need to head.
And Brownback, who, by the way, took office in 2011, defended his record at that debate. Let's listen.
Yes, we have cut taxes, and we've cut them so we could get growth happening, and the growth is happening. We are growing three times faster private sector jobs on the Kansas side of Kansas City as on the Missouri side because the taxes are lower and people can grow more here, and that's what we're seeing.
And is anyone listening to that message, Frank?
Well, yeah, everyone's listening, but they're also living it. And, you know, when the governor talks about those job growth numbers, Kansas, Missouri, he's talking about a slice of the border, not the entire border. And Kansas has very low unemployment, but the job growth has been really sluggish compared to other Midwestern and High Plains states. So this big jump hasn't really happened. In the meantime, the state has been saddled with huge budget shortfalls, hundreds of millions of dollars, and unlike most states, it hasn't been able to restore the cuts from the recession to education and slash the highway program, as Representative Davis said. So regardless of who's elected, the legislature is going to have to make big cuts next year, like 5% or 10% on top of the cuts that have already been made.
And this race, by the way, is one of the reasons why the Senate race in Kansas is in play.
Well, that's right. I mean, because you have a Republican in trouble there's this little sort of groundswell or a revolt against conservative Republicans in Kansas. I mean, Kansas has long time had a three-party system with a sharp division for a couple of decades between the conservatives and moderates in the GOP. And so you have, you know, that whole wing of the party is kind of under assault this year after winning huge gains in the last couple of elections.
Okay, well, there you have that. Now we want to go to Connecticut. John Dankosky, news director at WNPR in Hartford, who also hosts the show Where We Live, which is just terrific. It's your turn, John. Hi.
Hi, how are you doing?
I'm good. And in Connecticut, you've got the Republican former private equity manager Tom Foley running neck and neck against first-term Democrat Danielle Malloy, Connecticut's first Democratic governor since 1986. Now, this is a rematch. The New York Times is calling it the thriller in Manila. Explain.
Well, I don't know if it's such a thriller. I mean, for us, it's been Well, it's been just about the nastiest campaign that we've seen in a very long time. This Wesleyan Media Project, they take a look at negative ads all around the country. They've mm-hmm. said this right now is the most negative campaign. And it's not just happening in the ads, Robin. It's happening every single time these two face off in the debates. They're sniping back and forth at each other. There's an awful lot of personal attacks, but there's also a lot going back and forth about policy. Tom Foley thinks, I want to run this state a little bit more like a business, and that's how he's attacking Dan Malloy.
Yeah, well, and the rematch aspect is that in 2010, Malloy just squeaked past Foley by less than half a point. Now Malloy was governor during the Newtown school shooting, the passage of gun laws after that. Remind us, how big a factor is that now?
It has been a big factor in this campaign. Of course, Dan Malloy's campaign has had to really tiptoe around this issue because he wants to show the leadership that indeed many people in the state saw him perform with during Newtown. But he doesn't want to talk about it, doesn't want to politicize it. The fact of the matter is, right after Newtown, he helped to push through some gun legislation, banning large-capacity gun magazines, mandating universal background checks, over objections of Connecticut's gun industry, including some gun lobbyists that are based right in Newtown. Tom Foley has gotten support from the gun lobby. The one thing I'll say quickly, Robin, is there is a third candidate in this race, Joe Visconti, who's very outspoken about guns. He's a former Tea Party activist. He's a Republican. He's the one talking an awful lot about guns in this. And right now, he's getting about 9% in polling.
He could be the spoiler. Well, you mentioned the ads. Here is a snippet of one from the gun industry group, the National Shooting Sports Foundation, which we remember is, as you say, just 3 miles from the Sandy Hook School in Newtown.
Governor Daniel Malloy led the effort to impose strict gun laws on Connecticut citizens behind closed doors. Then Governor Daniel Malloy attacked one of his state's historic industries on national television.
What this is about is the ability of the gun industry to sell as many guns to as many people as possible.
And, of course, the gun industry is denying that. But is it going to turn on guns or is it going to turn on the economy? Malloy points to, you know, falling unemployment.
Yeah, absolutely. Dan Malloy is saying we're bringing jobs back to Connecticut. It's been a very, very slow recovery over time. Tom Foley is saying the recovery has not been fast enough. Really, Robin, what I think this is going to hinge on, it's how much people like these folks. 51% in the most recent Quinnipiac poll of those asked just don't have a very favorable view of Dan Malloy. He was on my show yesterday saying, hey, people don't have to like me. I'm a porcupine. I understand I'm prickly. You don't have to like me, but I'm getting the job done. We'll see what happens.
John Dankowski, his show is Where We Live, which is in Connecticut. He's with WNPR there. Where do we go now, Jeremy?
We're heading to Colorado and Megan Verlee with Colorado Public Radio. Megan, there you've got a Democratic Governor John Hickenlooper who was elected 4 years ago. A lot has happened in Colorado since then. He's facing the Republican nominee Bob Beaupre, who's a buffalo rancher and a former congressman. But we've had marijuana legalized in Colorado in the last few years. There was, of course, the Aurora Theater shooting. What's the big issue in Colorado this time around?
You know, in the election, I would say a lot of it's coming down to how people feel about Governor Hickenlooper's record, actually, his style of leadership. Certainly, the economy seems to be improving tremendously. We actually just got news today that unemployment is at its lowest since June 2008. But his opponent, Republican Bob Beaupre, says that the improving economic numbers mask a lot of structural weakness. And it is kind of interesting looking at how well Colorado's economy is doing on paper. If people, if voters don't give Hickenlooper a second term, does that actually bolster this idea that underneath the good numbers, with increasing economic disparity in how that good news is being felt, there may be a lot of voters who do not think the economy is strong enough to give the governor another term?
Well, we did hear about all of this at a recent debate, and let's listen here to Bob Beaupre, and here's what he had to say about the issue of regulation.
I wonder if anybody out there really thinks what's been holding us back, getting this economy moving again, is that we haven't been regulated enough. I don't think so. What we have to do first is freeze non-essential regulations. If it's not public safety related, let's stop where we're at, go through and audit everything we have. If it's not pro-job, pro-economic opportunity, let's get rid of it.
And Governor Hickenlooper responded. He said he's already eliminated over 1,500 regulations and that he's working to make regulations effective. He gave an example of a new law that tamps down on methane pollution from fracking. Here he is.
When we went after methane, right, we're the first state in America to regulate methane and fugitive emissions, but we didn't do it by imposing regulations. We sat down with the environmental community and the oil and gas industry spent the time to agree on definitions and then create a set of regulations that is now a national model.
How are issues of regulation, fracking, especially with the natural gas boom that's going on in this country right now, and the environment playing into this election?
Well, oddly enough, they've become sort of a lose-lose issue for Hickenlooper. On the one side, more conservative voters, I think, just tend to see him as a Democrat in sort of the traditional more regulation model. He definitely, you know, has trumpeted getting strict air regulations, first in the nation air regulations on the oil and gas industry. But on the other side, you have a lot of more liberal voters who are really concerned about the pace of oil and gas development in the state. It's starting to move into heavily suburban areas along the Front Range. And those voters who are traditionally strong Democratic supporters, you're hearing from them that they're frustrated that Hickenlooper hasn't done more and that they are not excited to try and reelect him because they feel he's let them down.
What are the polls saying?
That it is incredibly close.
Yeah.
You know, this has been a neck and neck race for a while now, also in our U.S. Senate race. And a lot of this is going to come down to a question of voter enthusiasm. Obviously, in a year like this, with a Democrat in the White House with unfavorable approval ratings, some of that may spill over even here into the state race.
Megan Verlee of Colorado Public Radio, and we were also talking with John Dankosky at WNPR in Hartford and Frank Morris at KCUR in Kansas City, all part of the Here and Now Contributors Network.
Thank you all. I feel like we just traveled the country. And here's some other notes of sitting governors in tight races. Maine's Republican Governor Paul LePage is in a tight race. The Democrat Pat Quinn in Illinois. Alaska's Republican Governor Sean Parnell. And here are some other governors' races worth watching. In Florida, the Republican Rick Scott and former Republican Governor Charlie Crist, now running as a Democrat, are essentially tied in the polls. Their third and final debate is tonight. In Wisconsin, it's a toss-up between the Republican Governor Scott Walker. In his first term, he garnered national attention, of course, for curbing collective bargaining rights. He's running against the Democrat and the businesswoman Mary Burke. In Georgia, you've got the first-term Republican Governor Nathan Deal trying to hold off a challenge from 39-year-old Democrat and State Senator Jason Carter, the grandson of President Jimmy Carter. In Pennsylvania, Democrats see a win as a businessman Mark Wolf leads in the polls over the Republican Governor Tom Corbett. But, of course, we will watch all of these races.
And in some of them, like in Georgia, and we just saw this when we were down there the last couple of weeks, there are third-party candidates that really could play a role in this election. Spoilers, or some people would say that's their candidate, but
right. We
will keep watching. Louisiana Governor Bobby Jindal issued an executive order last night demanding better protection for rape survivors. That came a day after the state health department proposed a ban on sending hospital bills to people who get treatment after a sexual assault. These changes are the result of one story published on NOLA.com and in the Times-Picayune. Rebecca Catalanello wrote the story. She's with us from WWNO in New Orleans. Rebecca, welcome to Here and Now.
Thanks for having me.
Well, lay out the problem, first of all, that you laid out and obviously has spurred all this response about rape survivors in Louisiana who are facing, in some cases, thousands of dollars in medical bills for care that they received after they were assaulted. What's going on?
Well, a woman who'd been recently sexually assaulted contacted our newsroom. She was outraged that she'd received a statement from her insurance stating that she'd be billed about $2,000 and then later got another statement showing about $1,400 in charges. She didn't have the money to pay for this, and she was newly insured and just couldn't believe that this was a thing. So I looked into her bills and started asking around, and what I discovered was that the situation in Louisiana when it comes to providing medical services for rape victims is really in a shambles. Whether or not sexual assault victims are billed and whether they have access to treatment really depends largely on what hospital they go to and in what parish or what you call counties.
And in what state? What does Louisiana law say about who's responsible for the costs of, for example, forensic medical exams?
So right now, law says that the local parish government should be picking up the bill for forensic medical exams, but that's just not happening in all places. In fact, in New Orleans, our hospital for years was picking up, our public hospital was picking up the bill for all of these services. And the reason why it came to our attention was because the management of that hospital changed and they started billing for the medical related medical costs like pregnancy tests, HIV tests, and other related lab works, and the ER fee.
And this is something that you report about happening in Louisiana, but Louisiana is not the only state where this is a problem. You've got a chart that goes along with your story that shows that this is really a nationwide problem. And in many states, there are not laws on the books that provide for the money to care for people after they are sexually assaulted.
That's right. The STD testing, pregnancy testing, HIV prophylaxis, all of that, and whether governments pay for those things are sort of left up to the local governments.
So we got this news from Governor Jindal last night. He's issued an executive order aimed at providing better protection for rape victims. He wants the Louisiana Board of Regents and the Crime Victims Reparations Board to take immediate steps, he says, to better protect victims of sexual assault. Is that going to do the trick in Louisiana?
The executive order, I think, was designed to be sort of an immediate action, barring the legislation that we're going to see in April. Our Department of Health and Hospitals released a plan Sunday night and early Monday saying that it's going to propose legislation to prohibit hospitals from billing victims for their medical expenses, including the ER fees, HIV prophylaxis, and pregnancy tests, and allow hospitals to bill the state's Crime Victims Reparation Fund immediately. It's also going to eliminate the provision that victims must report to police in order to have their bills covered, which exists right now under the Crime Victims Reparations Fund. So I think this executive order sort of tells the Crime Victims Reparations Fund to immediately change some of its rules regarding who's eligible for the compensation, but it's not going to completely change the way that we are dealing with this issue. I think it's going to take some legislation to fix that.
Rebecca Catalanello, who's been reporting for NOLA.com and the New Orleans Times-Picayune all about this issue. We've got a link to her reporting at our website, hereandnow.org. It's obviously causing quite a stir in Louisiana, where many lawmakers, including the governor, have responded. Rebecca, thank you so much.
Thank you so much.
And now we want to have a conversation with critical care nurse Katie Kleber of North Carolina. Her blog is called Nurse Eye Roll, after all the times nurses have to roll their eyes and carry on. She posted a letter to fellow critical care nurse Nina Pham when Nina contracted Ebola, but her sentiments apply to the second nurse, Amber Vinson, as well. And over 85,000, many nurses, have read her letter. Katie, thanks for joining us to talk about it.
Hi.
Why did you want to write a letter to Nina Pham?
Well, you know, I was kind of like the rest of the country watching, and, you know, I saw this stuff about Nina, about Ebola, but I never really saw anything to her.
Well, could you read a little bit for us? I pointed out a paragraph I'd like you to start at. You introduce yourself, and then you go on to say this. Why don't you pick it up?
I wanted to let you know that this nation of nurses stands behind you. We commend you for going to work, putting on your protective equipment, and putting your life at risk to stand at the bedside of a deathly ill and contagious patient for 12 hours at a time. Thank you. We know how tedious and difficult it is to put on and take off full protective gear over and over again. We know how hot, sweaty, and unbearable it gets. We know what it's like taking care of critically ill patients with constantly changing needs. We know what it's like standing at the bedside of someone for hours at a time, knowing that life is slowly leaving his or her body. We know how much that hurts mentally, physically, and emotionally. But because we are nurses, we are expected to deal with it with a smile on our face and carry on. I hope you're doing the best you possibly can be kicking Ebola's butt. I hope your nursey vitals are stable, your labs are improving, and that you're playing pranks on all of the nurses taking care for you. Try to resist the urge to interpret your own telemetry strip.
What's a telemetry strip?
Our heart monitor.
Yeah. What do you want people to know about critical care nurses?
You know, if you think about someone who is critically ill, meaning they need constant monitoring by someone. So you as their nurse are responsible for absolutely everything for them, from toileting and bathing to their managing all of their complex medications, and then add on that they're on isolation and whatnot and keeping yourself safe and your other patients safe. It's very, very rewarding, and I absolutely love it. And that was one of my whole reasons for making the blog and writing all my posts, is because I want people to be as comfortable with it as soon as possible, because it takes a while to get, you know, to get used to caring for dying people. As a critical care nurse, you see it every day, and it can be someone who is in their 90s that is, you know, you know, passing away peacefully, or it's someone who is in their 30s and you walk in and the first thing you see is his wife finding out he's dying, you know. And then also on top of that, you got to care for the patient in the room next to you and pretend like everything's fine when you go into that room. Something that's essential to me is prayer. My husband, we pray together every day. I pray every day I go to work.
Have you and other nurses had conversations about picturing yourself in a room with an Ebola patient?
Yeah, I think we all have. And it's why it hits so close to home, because it's the people that were standing with him while he was in the hospital that got infected. It could be you, you know, Nation of Nurses. There's a great community of nurses on social media and everybody just kind of supporting each other. And Ebola is scary, but it's the flu season. The flu is deadly as well. That can be just as scary if you're taking care of a critically ill flu patient.
You could catch that through the air.
Exactly.
Yeah. As tough as this episode has been, it has put nurses front of mind for a lot of Americans.
I think it is, too, because if you think about, for every Ebola patient that we have, there's got to be nurses standing at their bedside 24 hours a day. And after a little while, that gets tough.
Yeah. Katie Kleber, her blog is Nurse Eye Roll. She posted an open letter to Dallas nurse Nina Pham. Katie, Nurse Kleber, thanks so much for speaking with us.
Oh, no problem. My pleasure.
Today, the CDC issued new guidelines authorizing more protective gear for critical care nurses working with Ebola patients and a buddy system to change clothes. And techies are raving about a new device, not the iPhone 6, which just broke all sales records, but Amazon's new e-reader, The Voyage, the latest in the Kindle series and the most expensive at $199. The New York Times headline reads, "Beats hardcovers." Really? Hard sell for book lovers. Katie Barrett is senior reviewer for the tech news site Recode. She's with us from Washington. And Katie, you say you've been testing your Voyage reading Gone Girl. By the way, Neil Patrick Harris just gave that book a rave on his Twitter feed. But how does it read on the new device?
Well, I have to say, this is really the luxury device if you are an e-reader fan. If you like holding a device in your hands that's not a book when you're reading, if you like that feel, you don't miss the old-fashioned pages and the smell of a book, this is really the next best thing.
Gold standard, we hear.
Yeah, you know, I think Amazon really kind of pulled out all the stops for this. They are betting that people want to spend on a really good quality e-reader. They're acknowledging that people will still spend the least amount for their original Kindle, which they also just updated. That's $79. And the mid-range is the Paperwhite now. That's $119. But this gets you all the way up to $199 for an e-reader. That's just the entry-level version of this Kindle Voyage. And that has Wi-Fi, but it comes with ads, so it's not even the top of the line. And it's still just an e-reader. Remember, it's not a tablet. It doesn't have all the functionality that you could find in, like, an iPad.
Right.
You know, the iPad, the cheapest version of the iPad is now $249. So, you know, it's kind of amazing that they're offering this option for people.
Well, and you can read on your iPad as well as look at videos and other things. So, and there are other readers out there. So what is it about this e-reader that obviously has made Amazon roll it out?
Well, there are three factors that I really focused on. First, it's sleeker, it's lighter, it's smaller all around than any predecessor Amazon has brought out. So it's a beautiful device to hold in your hand. Second, they have this special light that's built in. It adjusts to the room that you're in. So if you're in a dark room, the light will automatically turn down, so it's easier on your eyes. If you're in a brighter room, the light cranks up a little bit. So it really is kind of smart. And then it also remembers your own settings. So if you constantly adjust the light from what Amazon's automatic light settings turn to, it will remember that. So there's an algorithm built into this Kindle that says, hey, you actually like it better this way, and I'll remember that. And the third feature I think that they've really added in here are sensors on the bezel of this Kindle that you can hold this kind of book-looking thing with both hands, and on either side you can use your fingers to press to turn pages, and they haven't had that in a long time.
Uh-oh, I think a technical term just flew by. A bezel?
Yeah, you know, a bezel is the edge of a screen.
Oh, so we call that the edge of the screen.
You can call it that too.
So just, Kate, obviously you're loving this, but it seems like it's the opposite direction from what we're hearing. You know, people have been moving to devices that do everything, phablets and big phones.
Yeah, you're right. Exactly. So I think it is an interesting turn in the opposite direction. But they really bet that people want a device that's solely dedicated to reading. And I think they're right, frankly. I have a lot of devices, as you can imagine. I test these things all the time. And they have tweets. They have Facebook messages. They have emails. They have iMessage. They have all sorts of things popping up and annoying me all the time. If I can sit and hold one thing and really read and get into a book, I kind of like that.
Yeah. Well, and Amazon's betting others will as well. Although I can hear some of our listeners saying, then get into a book with a book. But of course,
yeah, exactly.
It's bulkier. Kate Barrett, a senior reviewer for Recode on Amazon's new e-reader, The Voyage. Thank you, Kate.
Thank you.
Jill Abramson, the former executive editor of The New York Times, made some news last night about her future plans. You may remember she was fired from The Times earlier this year, and in an interview with New York Times journalist David Carr at an event at Boston University, she said she's planning to team up on a new venture with journalist Steve Brill. The audio has not been broadcast until right now.
I am very seriously thinking about joining, it's sort of back to the future for me, joining Steve Brill, who you know,
yes.
And we actually are pitching a startup that will be very, like, not unsurprisingly, like, very ambitious, killer journalism. We're talking to some investors who are sounding very interested, and we are going to do great stories and offer great journalists actually money that they can live on to write something wonderful for us.
Get on your Twitters. So are you gonna type or type on a keyboard composed of human beings? Are you gonna run something, or are you gonna do your
I'm gonna own? Try and do both, because we're not trying to start like a whole magazine or a full website. We're talking about doing a discrete number of great pieces, and I would be involved in recruiting the writers, in helping edit and conceptualize the stories. And Steve won the National Magazine Award this past year for a great story he did on healthcare costs.
Oh yeah, for Time.
That for Time, and he and I are both gonna do one big story a year.
Jill Abramson speaking with New York Times journalist David Carr at an event sponsored by WBUR and the Boston University College of Communication last night. I moderated the event and asked David Carr about the future of media, starting with the question of what he would say to a student who was thinking about going into print journalism.
If there's a student in the audience who's majoring in print journalism, I'd probably tell him to switch to something more forward-looking, like blacksmithing, for instance. We kid because we love, okay? There is very much a place in journalism for the person who can create a 400 to 1,000-word piece of copy that's clean, that tells you something you don't know. That's a fungible skill that will... It's a movable feast that should transport to many different realms. I'm kind of a print bull in part because it's how I eat. It's how I get hamburgers, is working at a newspaper. I do think that there is print value in that it has the ability to convey, you know, if you have an iPad and you're reading something, you see that person like on an airplane or a bus, you know that they've got $400 to spare. But if you see them reading an issue of The Economist, you know something else about them. I think people will continue to want to, in certain instances, to use print as a kind of intellectual jewelry and a way of showing others.
People all over the country, people in small towns the way that they do now, or people just in New York and Washington and Boston and L.A.?
Well, oddly enough, in small towns, the print press is doing pretty well. If you're running a community paper, the kind that puts your daughter's soccer game in, you're probably doing all right, because you can't take a web page and get it up on the fridge, right? When they show your daughter's soccer team. So those guys have done pretty well. Larger papers like us, the Washington Post, the Wall Street Journal, done okay. It's the middle parts that have been really clobbered, the great regional papers that have been really hurt, but you can't count them out. I spent the weekend reading the Boston Globe, which, you know, you heard all this stuff about how deep a hole they were working from. Pretty damn good paper.
What has been the biggest surprise for you in the media and how it's changed? Something you didn't see coming? Maybe even something that if you were to go back now, you wish you would be able to do a story about it before it showed up. But you and others missed it. What would be the biggest surprise?
Almost every week brings things I had no idea was coming. I've, you know, people always, you know, come and talk to us about the future of media, and I'm like, I have no clue. You know, if you said to me a couple years ago, yeah, Jeff Bezos is going to buy the Washington Post, what? I'm stunned by so much of what's going on. I've kind of gotten out of the future business. I have trouble keeping up with the present.
Well, let's talk about the present then for a second. One of the things that I know from personal experience exists in almost every newsroom is a series of televisions up on the wall showing the cable news channels 24 hours a day. Do you think that they have an outsized influence on the media because they're kind of the video wire service now that we all rely on to keep up to date with the latest of what's happening?
I can't think of a time in history when cable news has had less of an influence on what's going on with the news cycle. Right now, they don't know where to look. The world is ending everywhere you look. So, you know, it's like Ebola, they're going to get you here. You know, Ukraine, things are blowing up over there. We're on the march in Syria. You just have to have your head on a swivel. They don't really know where they're going, let alone setting an agenda. That we're all being pushed around by a ferocious news cycle right now. Pretty dark one, by the way.
Because of the news.
Yeah, the news is crazy right now.
But what about how they're handling it? The idea that all day long we're seeing every tick of the Ebola story, something that, as has been pointed out multiple times, has only killed one person in the United States. Is that lack of context on their part, or is that just the news cycle?
I'm not for fear-mongering. I don't look for me to be walking around with a surgical mask anytime soon. But in terms of I think for once the media franticness, if not the tenor of the coverage, at least the amount of it, is warranted.
David Carr, thank you very much.
An absolute pleasure.
David Carr of the New York Times speaking with me last night at an event at Boston University. And you can listen to or watch the full event, including our conversation with Jill Abramson, at hereandnow.org.
Jim Gaffigan has made a career out of making fun of himself, his beautiful "Why Did She Marry Me?" wife, and their five kids, and his obsession with food. Here's part of his Hot Pocket bit.
I buy the Hot Pockets. I go in grocery stores. I'm like, yeah, I'll get these. I've never eaten a Hot Pocket and then afterwards been, I'm glad I ate that. I'm always like, I'm gonna die. I paid for that?
Hot Pockets, biscuits and gravy. As Jim says, the South will never rise again because they won't have the energy. In his new book, Food, A Love Story, Jim Gaffigan pays reverent homage to them, as well as bacon and donuts, while excoriating fish, farmers markets, Whole Foods. And there are tender moments as well about his dad and his family, so there is more than one love story in Food, A Love Story. And Jim Gaffigan joins us from NPR West with more. Welcome.
Thanks for having me.
Let's go to the Hot Pockets chapter, shall we?
Surely.
Because you say right there, unless you are filthy rich and only shop at farmers markets, or perhaps you are a Unabomber, you may not know what a Hot Pocket is. But just humor us. What is a Hot Pocket?
Essentially, it's an empanada. Or it's a Jamaican meat pie. There's a pastry filled with some type of meat or vegetable product. In the Hot Pocket example, it's filled with poison. But it's it's essentially a portable – it's the evolution of American eating. You know, it's three steps after the TV dinner. We've gotten to the Hot Pocket. And I got lucky. I did some jokes on it, and it seemed to coincide with – Hot Pockets really kind of exploding. You know, there's not a single college student or a teenager that hasn't come across a Hot Pocket.
And you became sort of the Hot Pocket person. You say there was a time when you were on CNN, you were just speaking very seriously about the good work of the Bob Woodruff Foundation. He's the former correspondent who was injured covering war. And then you realized that there was a name under your image?
Yes. I was listed as Jim, quote, Hot Pocket, quote, Gaffigan. And, you know, but there's something about the whole Hot Pocket experience. It's a strange, never-ending kind of relationship I have. I know that I wouldn't have my career if I didn't have these Hot Pocket jokes and if they didn't keep introducing Hot Pockets. You know, it's strange because writing this book, comedians, you know, all artists or creative people, they don't want to be pigeonholed. But I've been writing so much about food or food comedy for 15 years now. And I, on my last special, I just kind of embraced it. That's not to say that it's exclusively what I talk about in my stand-up. But as a friend described, you know, I talk about food the way a morbidly obese person would talk about food.
But you are not morbidly obese. You say perhaps a little overweight. What is this defense of the foods that are almost indefensible?
I think there's something in our culture where we love to demonize things. And so maybe I'm coming to the defense of McDonald's saying, I'm not proposing that we eat it every day, but we shouldn't feel shame if you're in a five-hour car ride with your kid and you go to McDonald's. These are guilty pleasures, similar to reading, you know, Us Weekly or having a $5, you know, Frappuccino. We know it's wrong, but it's not the end of the world if we have guacamole.
Is part of this, too, kind of a class exploration as well? I mean, one whole chapter is on water. It's entitled More Watery Water, which is how you viewed it when bottled water came out. Oh, it's more watery than water.
Yeah.
But you point out that Evian is naive spelled backwards.
Yes, it is. And, you know, some of it is as a comedian, you know, I see some of this as just a humorous take on things that are not, you know, not divisive. I mean, I think I've thought long and hard about why I focus so much on food. And some of it is I don't want a quarter of the room of a stand-up room to feel horrible about themselves. But if I go on after seafood or shellfish, even a lobster, you know, a lobsterman's not going to be that offended. He's just going to understand that it's my point of view. So I think food is just a ripe topic where I can have very strong, passionate points of view and not really, no one gets hurt.
Yeah. Well, as you point out, you're from the Midwest. Was it Indiana?
Yes.
Grew up in Indiana. And so to you, fish are like insects. I love when you say even fish look like they're always smelling something bad, and they are.
Yeah, they're always frowning. And they're like, what's that smell? Oh, it's me. And some of it is I wish I liked fish. I wish I liked caviar. Even some sushi, that sea urchin, where they have those orange balls that look like Finding Nemo's mom and his siblings. It's like, how can we eat those? And I'm a meat eater, and I love animals, and I have a lot of respect for vegetarians, but it's really the plants are just slower at running away from us, really.
Is it really true that you recently saw an apple and didn't recognize it? You're so disconnected from fruit?
Well, there is some of it's exaggeration. I do believe that the only appeal of fruit is that it's more appealing than vegetables.
You write, you thought, what is that, a paperweight? But you go on to defend your theory that nobody wants fruit by pointing to paintings in museums with
bowls of fruit. Yes, that's why there are so many paintings in museums of just bowls of fruit. Because if you start a painting a bowl of fruit, you could leave for a couple hours and come back, and no one would have touched the bowl of fruit. But if you're painting a donut, you better finish it on the first setting, because you can't even do a bathroom break without coming back. And you're like, hey, what happened to my donut? And your friends are like, oh, some fat guy ate it. You know, that's why there's no paintings of donuts, or a very rare amount.
That's stand-up comic Jim Gaffigan. You're listening to Here and Now. Well, as we said, the title of the book is Food, A Love Story. You truly love your wife and kids, and they must love you to put up with some of this. But also, I mean, you talk about how, and it seemed like a serious section, you know, your dad made steaks, and sometimes the ash from his cigarette falls in them. But God love him, he could not afford steaks when he was growing up in the Depression.
There is something about, and I thought was so interesting about steak, is that my father's view of steak is something that I now have and I now understand. And, you know, I remember him saying, we're going to have steak tonight. Like, it was a big, fancy thing. Like, Abe Lincoln was going to come over for dinner, and I didn't really care. But the thing that I love about steak and about different relationships, and it's why my acknowledgments, I really associate different food with people. You know, my Aunt Katie, who used to buy us pints of ice cream, it's, you know, it's personal to me, but it's also, I think we all kind of have that connection. Mm-hmm. I mentioned in the book that if I died tomorrow, some of my children, I have five young children, would just remember me as the balding guy who used to bring home the expensive green dip of guacamole. So
I somehow doubt that. But what is the one food that, if your patient wife and your doctors, you know, said, you have got to give this up, and you wouldn't, what would it be?
I think cheese would be pretty hard. And I don't think there's a replacement. You know, we can put a guy on the moon, but we can't develop a non-dairy cheese that doesn't taste like rubber.
Hey, what about tofu?
Tofu is, you know, a lot of people don't know, that's what caused the Cultural Revolution. It, you know, the Chinese don't have cheese, and, you know, it was such a rich cultural heritage, but I think if they had a good cheese, we would not have seen some of what happened with that Cultural Revolution.
Jim Gaffigan, he treats his body like a temple of doom, and his book is Food, A Love Story, A Meditation on Many of His Favorite Foods and His Family. Thank you so much.
Thank you. Appreciate it.
By the way, Jeremy, in his book, he also lists the places fans tweet him, like when he comes to town for a stand-up comedy, and they send him to their favorite, this is going to kill you, food place. So feel free to do that. Here Now is a production of NPR and WBUR Boston in association with the BBC World Service. I'm Robin Young.
I'm Jeremy Hobson. This is Here and Now.